In the Canadian justice system, animals' interests are rarely represented, but the lawyers at Animal Justice fight to give them a voice in court and the political system. This is the Paw and Order Podcast, and these are their stories.
Hello, welcome to the Paw and Order Podcast. I'm your co-host, Camille Labchuk, and I'm here with my other host, Peter Sankoff. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Camille. How are you doing today?
I'm not so bad. Not so bad. How have you been doing?
A little tired of winter, a little sick with the flu. It's been a miserable couple of weeks since we last caught up, so gotta be honest.
Well, sorry to hear that, but yeah, I guess if we're all being honest, this time of year is just kind of a downer. I'm totally ready for spring myself. I was actually in Toronto last weekend, and it was pretty nice and sunny, and I walked around the city and just thought, like, oh, why can't this last? It needs to get better.
Yeah, well, it's like minus 10 today in Edmonton. Like, I'm just done. I've had it. I've done. I'm so done with winter. I think I'm going to burrow into a hole and come up again when it's, like, positive 10.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I often wonder why we live in a country where you can actually die if you stay outside for too long.
It is ridiculous, and we are entering month 6 of winter. There are only 12 months in a year, Camille. So if I am having 6 of them, and it looks like we are going to get a full 6 in Edmonton, a full 6 months of winter, there is something horribly wrong here. And remember, Lucy the elephant lives here. Like, this is like Lucy, who was born in, you know, tropical climates, is spending 6 months of her year in winter. It's so insane.
Yeah, that's actually a really good reminder. And one thing I often think about myself when I'm feeling down on the weather is think of all those animals who are being transported right now to slaughter in open-sided vehicles because there's no legal requirement to put them in insulated trucks. So they're exposed to extreme weather. You know, at least for me, I can wear my Woolly brand jacket, my excellent warm parka, but these guys just have no protections. So I guess that's a good reminder that...
Camille, we have no sponsorship deal yet. Woolly, we're talking to you. So until we get an official sponsorship, there are no plugs. No plugs allowed.
I'm going to give them an unofficial plug anyway because I just love my Woolly jacket so much. Shout out to our friends at Woolly.
Camille, you're forfeiting the tens of dollars that we could get for advertising on this podcast.
We could be rich.
Yeah, I'm ready to quit my day job any day.
So, Peter, apart from your day job, I think that you had an op-ed in the Globe and Mail recently.
I did. I have not done a Globe and Mail op-ed in a while. And shout out to our friend at Dalhousie Law School, Jody Lazar. It was actually her idea to start up with an op-ed. And I came in at a fairly early stage, and we decided to work on it together. It follows up on essentially that epic rant we had in our last podcast about the Baker versus Hermina case. And we were just so upset about it, we decided to write about it and put something together for the Globe and Mail.
Well, I love that you were in the Globe talking about why animals need to, especially in the family law context, be considered like something other than just tables and chairs and furniture that can be divided easily in the case of a divorce. It's obvious to us and probably to most people listening to it, but I hope that Globe readers will pick up on that and agree.
Me too. Something's got to change here, Camille. We can't keep... As excited as we were about that dissenting judgment, I found myself talking about that case in my animal law class last week, and I just found myself getting really angry about the fact that we're still dealing with dissenting judgments, as good as they are. Obviously, it's a step up from nothing, but it's really frustrating that the courts have not seen fit to move in this direction.
Yeah, we remain ever hopeful that pretty soon we'll see the majority judgments coming out in favor of animals, and the dissent or the people who are slow to get it. But I digress.
Yeah, absolutely. What you been up to, Camille?
Well, I was in Toronto last weekend. I stopped by the venue for the Animal Justice 10-year anniversary gala, another plug. It's going to be held at this beautiful event space called The Burrows near Queen West and Bathurst in Toronto. And I'm just even more excited about this gala event now that we did a site visit and started sketching it out a little bit more. And the cool thing for you listeners is that tickets for the event are going to go on sale really soon, within the next week. So watch for an email from us and subscribe at animaljustice.ca if you're not already on our list and you want to hear about it. And Peter, the other cool thing I did in Toronto is sit down for a meeting with one of our summer students. So
summer students, hooray.
Summer students, so cool news. We got two summer students. We have got two summer students so far this year. And one of them in Toronto, Alyssa, she's a student at Osgoode. She got a grant from Osgoode to, and that's a law school for those of you who may not know that, but Osgoode generously gives out these grants for students to do public interest work over the summer. So Alyssa's going to join us and work on probably some projects related to exotic animal regulation and possibly also cat declawing issues, which is something we might be starting to ramp up on. So that was really cool. And a couple of days after I met with Alyssa, I got news from a U Ottawa student, shout out to Crystal, hey Crystal, that she was also approved from a grant from Ottawa U. So really cool. We're going to have Alyssa and Crystal with us for the summer. And I'm just really glad that we can take on students at Animal Justice and do that work of fostering the next generation of animal rights lawyers.
Absolutely. That is fantastic. Maybe we'll have to have them on a guest episode of Paw and Order to sort of see how their summer's going.
That's a fun idea. That's a fun idea. Maybe we can get them to answer all these listener questions that we always think about.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Throw them into the fire.
Some of the work.
Trial by fire.
Good stuff. Good stuff, Camille.
Yeah. And so following up on our last conversation, our last episode as well, we got some listener feedback from someone I think is just awesome, Dr. Jonathan Balcom. He's a biologist and author of the amazing book, What a Fish Knows. And if you guys haven't checked this out already, I strongly suggest that you pick up a copy at your library or the bookstore. It's a deep dive, forgive the pun, into what fish think, how fish act, the relationships that they form. You just learn so much about these amazing little creatures that we often disregard. Fish are the most abused animals on the planet, and we kill the most number of them. We don't even measure their lives in numbers. We just measure their lives in tons. Anyway, so Dr. Balcom has written about fish extensively, and he had a comment based on our segment last episode where we gave a hero award to the woman who'd started this discussion about getting lobsters out of tanks in grocery stores in New Brunswick. And Peter, there was some skepticism expressed that lobsters would be caught under the criminal code animal cruelty laws. And so Jonathan says, regarding your last episode number 5, I wanted you to be sure that you knew that lobsters are squarely classified biologically as animals, being members of the kingdom, or queendom if you like, Animalia. Whomever drafted the Canadian law you referred to must have been laboring under the unscientific delusion that animal refers to mammal. That is just wrong. Since the law seeks to protect animals, perhaps this bit of linguistic laziness can be used to the lobster's advantage. So Peter, just to remind our listeners, the criminal code says that it applies to animals or birds. It's a weirdly drafted thing.
Very weird.
And I know you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I appreciate Dr. Balcom's thoughts. Thanks for writing in to us. I'm just a little skeptical. I am not a biologist. I'm just a lazy lawyer who knows that the courts are not always concerned with the way in which science defines things. They're more concerned with the indications in statute. And I guess the problem that I have with Dr. Balcom's interpretation, which I went online and looked up again, I'm not an expert, is that the problem is that Kingdom Animalia is essentially every complex organism is in Kingdom Animalia. So effectively, it covers everything. So the designation of animal from Kingdom Animalia covers every single animal there is. And I guess the problem is, the question that would arise in an actual court case, if one were to arise, is, well, what did the criminal code, what did the drafters of the code mean by using the term animal? And if we accept Dr. Balcom's suggestion, it means Kingdom Animalia, which includes everything, literally down to simple mollusks like scallops and shrimp and whatever, all the most the simple organisms. But what troubles me is that it also includes birds. So essentially what the court would have to decide is that Parliament intended animal to include Kingdom them animalia, but nonetheless decided to include the term bird. And I don't think that's the most likely interpretation. I think that the court would have to look for a different interpretation of animal, however much that seems to conflict with scientific definitions.
Yeah, one thing is for sure is that the criminal code is like decades, I would say close to a century out of date at this point. And the fact that you've got these two terms, animals and birds, in there just makes no sense whatsoever since birds are animals. So who knows what the court would do? I think obviously...
Who knows?
Who knows? We're continually surprised by what courts end up doing with animals.
I mean, keep in mind that in the 1950s, before the law was adapted, they had a list of animals. And it was essentially domestic animals with some birds listed in it. You know what I mean? It was essentially all mammals and birds. And what I think... I mean, again, I can't predict exactly what the court can do. I can just tell you the way in which the cases have come forward, that what it means, I think animal is most likely to mean mammal, and I think it's most likely to be interpreted that way, whether that's the correct intention or not, because as you've raised with me before the show, you know, it raises questions about reptiles. But, I mean, they're interesting questions. The problem is there have never been cases pushing the limits of animal, and I think the courts would look to that as well. They would essentially canvass the case law and say what types of cases have been prosecuted. And the answer is, you know, domestic animals and birds. Those are the only cases that have been prosecuted. So the idea that the term would take on the expansive version, you know, that would include a lobster, while it's possible, I'm not completely dismissing what Dr. Balcom says. I'm not convinced it's the most likely interpretation.
Well, if I were a prosecutor in this case, I would certainly argue that it did. And, you know, I think one of the issues here, as you mentioned, Peter, is that we have so few of these cases actually being prosecuted. Like, the state of animal cruelty prosecutions in Canada, I think, is impoverished. And if we actually had aggressive agencies and crowns bringing these cases and seeking expansive interpretations of these words, maybe we would have some more guidance. But, you know, ultimately it comes back to this idea that our criminal laws are so out of date that we still use these outdated and conflicting definitions.
Right.
So maybe someday we'll see a lobster case.
Maybe. And it's worth noting that the 1999 proposed reforms, one of the focuses was to improve the definition of animal, and it would include lobsters, and it was designed to sort of separate out which animals should be in and which animals are out. And the New Zealand Animal Welfare Act and several other, you know, more progressive pieces of legislation around the world have tried to do this. Now, let me just say, sometimes with effects that Dr. Balcom and us, we would disagree with, like several of the animal welfare legislation that define these things in depth. I remember the New Zealand legislation excludes fish for some actually, I'm not sure the New Zealand one currently excludes fish, but I've seen versions of animal welfare legislation that exclude fish but include lobsters and crustaceans. So, for example, even there is some distinctions that are problematic in terms of, you know, what we're actually supposed to be trying to do, which is prevent animal pain and suffering.
Yeah, and it really just, like, all these weird definitions really speak to how out of step the law is with what people assume when they hear the word animal. Like, you can't just think, oh, that's an animal cruelty law. It applies to all animals. You really have to go look at the statute and see how it's been defined and interpreted. And oftentimes you're going to be surprised by what it includes and excludes.
Well, the good news is I'm sure our federal government is right on this. There's big criminal justice announcements today, and I'm literally holding my breath for the excitement that they have decided to comply with their 2015 pledge, which I continue to remind people of. That's going to be one of my hobby horses that I go on. When Undersecretary for the Minister of Justice, Bill Blair, got up in his effort to kill Bill 246, C-246, which had been brought by Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, by saying that the criminal code is being completely reformed and we will deal with this when we reform the criminal code. We are 2 years on and there is not a hope in sight that this actual reform is on the agenda.
Yeah, it's really hard to take the government seriously when it says, oh yeah, we're totally reforming the entire criminal code and animals are going to be part of that, but then you don't see any action on it for 2 years. So I'm not really surprised.
Any day now.
Any day now, Peter. Any day now.
Michael, I mean, Camille. Any day now.
This is an inside joke that we have with some other friends. Shout out to Michael and Emily on the Docket podcast about how the government's going to do something any day now on the criminal code.
And yeah, we can both complain.
That day never comes.
We can complain on the criminal side, on the animal justice reform side. We can all complain that the government's done a lot of talk, very little action.
Yeah, that's a recurring theme in this podcast and in animal law. So with that, Peter, why don't we move on to our main segment?
All right, let's get there.
All right, so today for our main segment, we're going to talk about false advertising and what that actually has to do with animal protection. This is a pretty cool topic, Peter. I know you've done some work in this area and studied it internationally. I actually wrote a chapter in a book, an excellent book by some excellent editors. It's called Canadian Perspectives on Animals and the Law.
And wow. What Peter, is that book all about, Camille? Let's talk a little bit more about that book.
Well, Peter is excited because he really drove the creation of that book. So Peter and our good friend and advisor, Katie Sykes, and other animal justice advisor, Vaughn Black, they're both law profs who focus on animal stuff. You three were the editors of that book, and maybe you can just explain briefly what it did.
Well, it was just the first Canadian book to actually bring together a bunch of professors and lawyers to write about animal topics, one of which was our topic of the day, which Camille Lapchuk wrote about, false advertising and how it impacts animals.
Yeah, so it the whole theory behind false advertising and what the heck it has to do with animal protection is that animal lawyers, we really need to be creative. And this is because typically the laws protecting animals are not very good, or maybe they're okay, but they're not being enforced well. Maybe there's just not enough there to go on. So we try to pull in other areas of the law that don't really on their face seem like they have much to do with animals, but can actually put animal issues front and center.
And I think there's a deeper message as well, Camille. I think there's like a deeper idea with false advertising than just being creative. I think that part of the problem that we are dealing with, at least the way I discuss it in my course, when we're talking about the impoverished nature of our animal cruelty laws and the inability to get prosecutions, is that we are facing a social consensus problem. We are facing this idea of are particular measures actually cruel or not? And when we're talking in the farming context where we're dealing with false advertising and the idea of how products are developed and made, we're often dealing with this idea that, well, cruelty isn't happening on the farm because the message that's being put forward from the industry is consistently that the animals are treated well, and that is displayed in nice, happy pictures of cows in fields and chickens, crowing in the morning. Well, I guess it's roosters crowing in the morning.
Yeah, and the classic example of this, as you point out, it's the humane meat myth. People sort of get this idea that there's some ways of producing meat or eggs or dairy products or even fur that are somehow slightly more ethical or do a better job of protecting the animals in the process. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what you think about this, Peter, but you can argue about whether some animals were treated better in certain situations in the farming context or whatever. But oftentimes what happens is there's a temptation by producers because they know people care about animals in some respect and they know people don't want to act unethically. There's this huge temptation to label products as more ethical or more humane than the reality actually bears out. And you see these terms like free-range eggs, like free-run eggs, like grass-fed beef, and people don't really know what those mean, but they get this sort of false sense of security that they're doing something a little better.
Well, it's more than that. A lot of these cases have been run in foreign jurisdictions on the basis of fraud, because not only do they label it that way, they charge more for it. And that becomes almost a form of fraudulent behavior, because you're essentially playing on the consumer's willingness to make an ethical decision and pay a premium for that ethical decision. And some of the undercover investigations in the UK that I showed recently to my class involved free-run farming that were just like these abominations of hens just climbing all over each other with urine and feces. Like, yeah, they're free run. They're outside of a cage. But the idea that there is some welfare benefit to this is what really brings this down to almost false and somewhat fraudulent behavior in extreme cases, to be sure.
Yeah, totally. Totally. There's a widespread perception now that buying eggs from caged hens is a bad thing because the caged hens suffer. But what I think people sometimes don't appreciate is that you take away the cages, but you're still stocking hens in really dense stocking densities inside barns, and they still aren't able to access any sunlight or fresh air or dirt to scratch in, and they're still overcrowded. There's still really serious welfare concerns, and some would say that free-run eggs are not all that much better than caged eggs for the welfare of the animals.
And in some ways, worse. It's trade-offs, right? There's different trade-offs to the, I almost hate getting into the animal welfare trade-off issue of like, yes, in some ways they're better in terms of they have somewhat more space and they don't get burns on their wings from, you know, smashing against the cages. But in other cases, they're worse because by allowing them into the general population, the spread of disease is risked higher. And it's just such nonsense. And you're right that the real issue in these cases, since we're on to chickens, is stocking density. I mean, broiler chickens have never been in cages and no one's claiming that they're doing exceptionally well in those closed warehouses where they're stocked, you know, by the thousands. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why don't I give listeners an example of, well, the reason that we're doing this episode today is because we got some news recently in one of these false advertising complaints that we filed. So maybe we'll go over that and then talk a little bit more about the law and some of the other cases that we've been involved with and that we've seen internationally. So, Peter, do you remember those Dairy Farmers of Canada transit ads that ran in 2016?
I do remember those, Camille, but at least vaguely. Tell me more.
Well, let me just give people a picture of what they look like. So, sponsored by the Dairy Farmers of Canada, it was called their Get Enough Transit campaign. And it was a series of bus ads, subway ads, bus shelter ads. Maybe they were in other places, but I just saw them in transit stations. And we got tons of emails at Animal Justice from people complaining about them. Because they aggressively promoted this idea that people should be drinking milk. And they want everyone to download this Get Enough app so they know that they're drinking enough milk. Now, there's lots of health drawbacks to consuming milk, and certainly tons of scientific research at this point that shows that milk is not necessary and may even be harmful to people. But what was particularly offensive about these ads is that they were pro-milk ads disguised as public health information. So the dairy farmers actually partnered with a whole bunch of disease foundations. There was the Heart and Stroke Foundation, Osteoporosis Canada, and the Colorectal Cancer Association of Canada. So let me just describe a couple of these ads. One of the partnerships with the Heart and Stroke Foundation, it's an ad that says, "Did you know high blood pressure is the number one risk for stroke and a major factor in heart disease?" And then it went on to tell people that they should get enough milk products to reduce the risk of these diseases and download this Get Enough Helper app on their phones to help them track consumption. There's a colorectal cancer ad with a big glass of white milk and the words "help prevent colorectal cancer." So the really clear implication, Peter, of course, is that drinking milk helps do this. And an osteoporosis ad with a big wedge of cheese and the words "help prevent osteoporosis."
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Kind of aggressive, which is not out of step for the dairy farmers.
Just hold on one sec, Camille. Camille, hold on one sec. I just got to pour myself a glass of milk because I'm worried about getting a stroke, colorectal cancer, and osteoporosis. I haven't had milk in like 14 years, but I'm really feeling thirsty for a glass right now.
I know. My 11-year vegan anniversary was just last week. And, you know, I think, Peter, you and I are just testaments to the idea that we do not need milk to be healthy.
It's so ludicrous, especially when it's so ludicrous. I'm surprised that the Heart and Stroke Foundation signs on to this. I'm wondering how much they got paid to do that. You know, oops. You know, I don't know that they did get paid. But it just seems so amazing because of the cholesterol that is involved in milk to begin with. Like, one of the benefits of being a vegan, and let me just say, I am never on this show or probably never going to push the vegan health angle. I think that's an important benefit of being vegan, but it's not why I'm vegan, and I don't tend to get into those arguments myself. I think there are perfectly ways you can eat meat and eggs and do so in a healthy way, so I never like to advance the health argument. But there's no question that cholesterol levels of vegans are just tend to be lower, and I had my cholesterol tested, and the doctor was like, "Oh my God, you have like zero cholesterol." like of the certain type of cholesterol that's not hereditary. And I think that's just a huge benefit for heart and stroke. It's just amazing to me that the idea that you should drink more milk is suddenly equated with good health.
Yeah, it really is amazing. And, you know, if any listeners want to follow up on this, I recommend checking out the films Forks Over Knives and What the Health, both of which feature interviews with tons of doctors who promote a vegan diet to reduce heart attacks and reduce the risk of stroke as well. So there's lots of evidence that vegan diets protect against these diseases, and very little that you need milk to guard against them or to be healthy at all. But Peter, I'm not surprised by this because it's the Dairy Farmers of Canada. They are one of the most aggressive food lobby groups in the country. They have an 80...
They're good. They're good at it.
Yeah, unfortunately. And you know why they're so good? It's because they spend $80 million on marketing alone every single year.
Oh, yeah.
We only know this because they were testifying in the House of Commons committee and that information came out. But just think of all the pro-dairy research, the lobbying, and you know, all that work that $80 million can do. One other thing they're doing is opposing the changes to the Canada Food Guide that would emphasize eating plant protein and de-emphasize consuming dairy.
Well, of course they are. I'm dreaming of the day when we have a $1 million budget, let alone an $80 million marketing budget.
I know, that's more than all the animal protection groups in Canada combined, by far.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. So obviously these ads are disturbing because they mislead people. The science shows one thing and the ads suggest something else. And of course, the veneer of authority and respectability that they've got with the health organization's partnership is also really disturbing to me. So our colleague Anna Pippis, Anna is our director of farmed animal advocacy, and I'm sure we'll have Anna on the podcast soon to talk about some of her work. But she prepared and filed a complaint about these ads. And the body that we complained to is the Competition Bureau of Canada. And they're in charge of enforcing the Competition Act, which is actually a powerful piece of legislation when it comes to false advertising in theory. It bans producers advertising from making representations about a product that are false or misleading in a material respect. And so, you know, when you look at these ads, the claim is that they're trying to mislead people into thinking that dairy is necessary and healthful to consume. So,
wow.
Yeah. So in theory, Peter, it sounds pretty good, right? You can't mislead people.
Sure sounds good anyway.
But do you think it actually turns out to be that great in practice? What's your guess?
I don't know, Camille. Our recent run of success hasn't been as high as I would like it to be. How has it worked with false advertising?
Well, unfortunately, we got a letter back from the Competition Bureau just last week saying that they had discontinued the inquiry. So one cool thing about the Competition Act and some of the measures it contains is that there's a mechanism in there to essentially force the Competition Bureau to start some sort of inquiry into a complaint. So if you get 6 Canadian residents to sign a statutory declaration saying that they believe there's false advertising going on, the Bureau has to start some sort of inquiry and look into this to some extent. So, Peter, as you know, we've now filed a bunch of these complaints through Animal Justice about various things. I filed one about Canada Goose falsely claiming that fur is humane and ethical. We filed them about a chicken company before that was caught in an undercover investigation doing awful things to chicken, yet they had still talked about being humane on their website. And every single time we do one of these, the Competition Bureau tells us that they've started an inquiry. And then a year and a half later, we get a letter back saying, guess what? They've determined that they're are no concerns under the Act, or something else really sort of dismissive without providing further information. So, disappointing.
Is there an ability to launch a judicial review of the Competition Bureau's decision?
It's tough because it's essentially prosecutorial discretion, which is really tough to review in Canada. Prosecutors have the ability, and so do police, to lay charges or not based on a variety of factors. And the Competition Bureau actually has guidelines as well for the things that it will pursue and it won't pursue. And it seems to me like they care a lot more about issues affecting the marketplace in a pretty substantial way with a lot of money and much less about animals, unfortunately.
So the problem we face is that the mechanism that's being used here is just a bit less effective than we'd like. It's not so much that the claim that's being made is is not a good one or not worth pursuing, but we're totally in the hands of the Competition Bureau to actually follow through.
Yeah, I actually think our claim is very strong. And, you know, we've tried to get more information to get behind their thought process and see what they're thinking and whether we can draft our complaints in a better way next time to address their concerns. But every time we file an access to information request under federal legislation, surprise, surprise, they block us. So the first time I filed one, they gave me back this response that relied on completely inappropriate exemptions to say they were going to deny all that information about how they made their decision. So that's being appealed. There's a process going on there. But, you know, there have been other countries where we've seen a much more sort of activist and aggressive Competition Bureau equivalent enforcing these laws. And I think one of those, Peter, was down in your old stomping grounds in the Australia region.
Right. Yeah, we've seen some of these win. Like in Australia, they won a case against battery hen producers for making false claims. And we've seen claims like that. One, I was involved in a case in New Zealand a long time ago. It was one of the first cases we ever won. That was the difference was that in New Zealand, they had an advertising standards board that was essentially an independent board that would deal with complaints. And this was a lamb and beef marketing board. One of the reasons I think we were successful was that, as I'm about to tell you, the claim that we raised involved a religious freedom rather than an animal-based claim. But essentially, they did this ad that essentially, it was literally the most ridiculous ad I've ever seen. It essentially involved people running through the streets. They were so excited to eat their meat and lamb that they were like literally doing chants. And essentially, they looked a lot like Hare Krishnas. And we actually represented the Hare Krishnas in New Zealand, saying, "Well, look, we're all vegan. So this claim is offensive to us and it offends our religion." And we won. The Advertising Standards Board came back and said, "No, there's definitely a link between this and the Hare Krishna religion, and it's inappropriate to make that claim that, you know, Hare Krishnas will love the smell of lamb and beef so much that they'll want to eat meat." So they actually pulled it off the air. It was sort of a false advertising standards issue in the case that it mocked religious groups. But it sort of shows the lengths to which you've got to go to sort of get some of these things pulled off the air.
Oh, that's so interesting. And there's almost a little parallel there between that case and this dairy farmer's transit ad case. One thing that we put in the complaint was that, you know, not only is this ad misleading, it's also discriminatory in a sense, because many people of many ethnicities that are especially not white people have a very difficult time digesting lactose. It's simply not easy for them to do so. And many folks are lactose intolerant. So suggesting that everybody needs to get enough milk is really culturally insensitive because some people can't consume milk at all.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Like, I remember when we lost the Canada Goose claim, I was a little bit less surprised about that. I mean, you may not have been, Camille, but I was less surprised about losing the Canada Goose because essentially Canada Goose was saying the way in which we trap animals is not cruel. And my response was that, well, given the stupid way we define cruel, you know, they can actually make that claim. Like the way in which cruelty is actually defined in this country is so loose, they can legitimately make the claim that their legal methods are not cruel. And, you know, you and I can sit here and say how ridiculous that is, but I can sort of see how that can get under the false advertising claim and the idea, well, it's not strictly false. The claim here seems to me to have much more merit, not that the other one didn't, but it seems to me a little harder to dismiss given that they're clearly linking to health claims and they're trying to promote an image of necessity when that's just simply not the case.
Yeah, and I would really love to know why the Competition Bureau decided to dismiss this inquiry and, you know, what information they actually relied on. Because it just seems so obvious to me. And, you know, I thought the Canada Goose one was obvious, too. They kept saying that they're really committed to the humane and ethical treatment of animals and responsible fur trapping. And, you know, the reality is, Peter, as you know, and many of our listeners will know, is that Canada Goose uses coyote fur, which it comes from coyotes who are caught in leghold traps. Leghold traps cause a lot of pain and suffering. The legal guidelines for which traps can be used, you know, they sort of do this testing process to evaluate them. And in field tests, up to 20% can show signs of severe injury, of broken skins, of broken bones, of, you know, just awful things happening to these coyotes, and that trap is still going to be approved for use. So, you know, at best, you might say that 20% of animals who die in these traps or who are caught in these traps still suffer significantly. And that's the standard that Canada Goose is trying to say is humane.
Well, I guess my point, my response to that is, I don't disagree with any of that. My response to that is, the definition of humane is one that in Canada, I would suggest, is very malleable. And the idea of what is and isn't humane seems to me to depend a lot. I mean, we could talk at length about whether the dairy industry itself is humane or the egg industry is itself humane. They would all say that they are. And the question is, are all those claims false too? And the point that I'm trying to make is that the word is so malleable that the fact that animals suffer dramatically in the action does not, to me, determine that the claim that they are humane is false in and of itself.
Yeah.
Simply because I think the term has been warped beyond recognition.
Yeah, I can appreciate what you're saying. There is no real definition of humane in most of our legislation, certainly not when it comes to fur trapping, for instance. You know, I think what animal advocates need to rely on is public opinion surveys. And we do have some of those that kind of suggest what practices people find to be humane or inhumane. But, you know, I don't think this is over yet. I can say on behalf of Animal Justice that we're really just getting started on false advertising. And we do see it as an area to keep pursuing in the future. One thing that's cool, Peter, is that we can actually sue companies ourselves for false advertising at some point if we want to.
Ooh, as long as we're willing to bear the cost sanctions if we lose, Camille.
I know, that's the problem. You may, if you've been listening...
Always our worry.
Yeah, if you guys have been listening for a few episodes, you've heard us talk about this before. But, you know, if you lose a case, you could be on the line for hundreds of thousands of dollars of costs. So it's not an easy proposition just to decide to sue somebody, but we're working on it.
Which, by the way, just as a total aside, I'm going to go on a mini rant about something that came up in my animal law class because it sort of links into that idea. We were just reading Reese versus Edmonton Zoo, and we were talking about it in class. And one of the things that drives me crazy about that case is the majority's argument, and we'll talk about Reese more fully, but this is the case involving Lucy and the Edmonton Zoo. And the majority goes on about how, well, we don't want to be dealing with cases where animal advocates are going to drag every government official, or we don't want to manage animal husbandry claims in the courts. And I'm like, what world are you living in? As if like every small group is going to bring these cases to court when the risks of cost sanctions are so dramatic. Like the idea that there's going to be this floodgates of animal cases, you've got to be kidding me. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
I could not agree more. I only wish we had the resources to drag every single little claim into court, but we don't.
It would be wonderful, but that's just never going to happen. The costs of losing and the risks of losing are just too high, especially when the law is you know, at the moment is not in our favor. We're trying to risk these public... Anyway, why am I getting into Reese versus Edmonton Zoo? It's like, it's just so, it's so irritating, this idea that, you know, that these public interest claims that I think are validly in the public interest, that the courts don't even recognize that. They just slam you with cost sanctions every time.
Yeah. We need to change the conversation. But before people get too discouraged...
Working on it.
And before people get too discouraged, I do want to say that one of our complaints so far, actually a couple of them have been somewhat successful. The most recent one is that we caught this accessory stores, Ardeen or Ardeen, I'm not sure how you pronounce it. We caught them red-handed selling real fur, probably rabbit fur from China, on some pom-pom socks. So I went to the store, I found a pair of these pom-pom socks because somebody had alerted us to them. And we submitted a complaint to the Competition Bureau about it because they were labeling the real fur as faux fur. And it's obviously real fur. I can spot fur from a mile away. We did a burn test on it. It was clearly real fur. So Ardeen, they did take those socks off store shelves. They were forced into it by the publicity from our complaint. So it's kind of a funny victory because the socks are no longer being sold. But the Competition Bureau hasn't responded with the results of their investigation, and this was a year ago, so who knows what they've actually done or found. So that's one.
Well, we'll take it as a win.
Yeah, it's still a win. The socks are off the shelves.
Absolutely.
And then the other kind of cool thing I mentioned earlier, we'd filed a complaint about a chicken processing company. It was Maple Lodge Farms, and they were hit with an undercover investigation by Mercy for Animals. This was 3 years ago, March 2015, and the undercover investigation was at a slaughterhouse. It just showed horrific abuse, animals arriving frozen alive, like hockey pucks, dead chickens just like hockey pucks, chickens being hung upside down by their feet with broken legs, being stunned improperly with an electric current and a water bath. And of course, Maple Lodge like had all this nice imagery on their website of like pastoral scenes and a farmer carrying a basket of eggs and all this stuff. So we complained about their language and their imagery, and a couple months later, they did change their imagery. They got rid of this sort of field-focused scene and put chickens inside a barn, which was more reflective of reality. So I think that doing these complaints is worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
Someday, we'll be in a position to sue. And I also, Peter, I would like to tell our listeners that this is something that you don't need a law degree to do. If you see something that's obviously false advertising, you can complain yourself to provincial authorities, to the Competition Bureau. You can go to the Ad Standards Canada, which is a body. It's not a legal body, but it sort of governs advertising. And they can order an ad removed if it doesn't meet their standards. So I encourage people to be mindful of this. Keep your eyes open for false advertising. And if you see it, report it. You might just get results.
Absolutely. Sounds like something that everybody can do.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for false advertising. If you have any questions about this, as always, feel free to write to us, info@animaljustice.ca, and we'll do our best to answer them in a future episode.
Heroes and Zeros.
All right, we are back, and it's time. It's time again, Camille, for everybody's favorite segment, Heroes and Zeros.
Heroes and Zeros.
Heroes okay. and Zeros. You going to... You're going to lead in with our hero of the month, Camille?
Yeah.
Month. I don't know why I say the month. Our hero of the 2 week period,
the
bi-weekly period
weeks.
That just finished. Yes.
So today, both of our hero and our zero, they're both provinces. So we're going to start with the province of Nova Scotia, which is our hero this episode. Nova Scotia just banned cat declawing. Yay! Bravo! This is...
way to go, Nova Scotia!
You're awesome, Nova Scotia. This is a total first for Canada. First province anywhere in this country to make cat declawing illegal. Now, obviously, it should be illegal. Cat declawing essentially involves cutting off at the second joint the fingers of a cat. If you were to compare that procedure to what it would look like on a human, you're removing the entire tip of that paw. It's not just like taking off a nail, it's cutting off a knuckle. It's sickening. It's just done for the sake of convenience. People kind of think it's on its way out, but I know it's not. I know somebody who works in a vet clinic, and I'm told that there's still 2 or 3 procedures every week where people come in to declaw their cats, and often there's horrible complications. The cats are in pain, they're suffering, and there's simply no need for this anymore. It's a cosmetic, sort of convenient practice. So I'm pretty happy about this, Peter.
Yeah, it's great news. And this is an amendment to their Animal Protection Act, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So it's right in there.
What's the language of the section, you know?
Oh, I don't have it in front of me, but you know what we'll do is we'll go and find that and post it in the show notes so people can actually see what it says.
Yeah, I think these types of changes are excellent. I felt the same way and said so after PEI banned dogtail docking in that province, because I think if you can't ban these sorts of things, you're never going to get to the more difficult things involving, aspects of animal use for food production. I mean, if we can't even get rid of cosmetic changes that cause incredible harm to the animals, it's very difficult to convince the public that more significant change needs to take place.
Yeah, I agree. And this is part of what I think is a global trend and what I think is going to start sweeping Canada soon, frankly. But several other countries have already done this. The entire country of Australia, from what I understand, the UK, Germany, some other parts of Europe, and even Denver and a number of California cities, which is not surprising because California is already leading the way. So I really see this being something it's going to sweep Canada. And if we have anything to do with it, that's certainly going to be the case.
Pretty fantastic. It is the type of measure we need to see more of, that's for sure.
Yeah, cool stuff. So our zero this week, Peter.
Our zero of the month is we are giving it to the government of Ontario. Should I say the outgoing government of Ontario, Camille, or is that too soon?
You know, who knows? For those of you who aren't in Ontario and aren't watching this context, the Liberals have been in power here for now 15 years. Doug Ford just became the PC leader, and a lot of people are predicting that he's going to be the next premier. The election's in June.
Anyway, yes, we'll leave that for another show. The Ontario budget, which found money in every nook and cranny for every pet project Ontario ever wanted to put into place, once again missed a golden opportunity to fund animal investigations. And they had there had been a wonderful plea by some people in the Toronto Star about the need for animal law enforcement in Ontario to get more money, really, more than the tiny stipend it gets, which doesn't even cover a fraction of the investigative power required to enforce animal law in the jurisdiction. And instead, the only mention of animals in the new budget is an excellence award given to a battery cage egg facility because the producers learned how to stamp the eggs with numbers so they could be tracked. That is what got passed for.
Yeah.
For animals in Ontario, again, not a dollar, certainly not a new dollar for animal investigations in that province.
Yeah, I just have to laugh. I found the budget document yesterday when it came out. That was Thursday. And I did a control F on the budget. And oh, look, there's two mentions of the word animals. Maybe this is going to be good. But no, they're talking about like animal health stuff. And when you hear the words animal health, that essentially means making animals healthier while they're being factory farmed so that you can increase the profits of producers. It's not about animal welfare. It's not about animal protection. And then there's this little text box underneath those mentions that says, oh, and Ontario has given out awards for excellence in agriculture. And one of those, as you mentioned, Peter, is to a battery cage egg facility, which learned how to stamp eggs with numbers so they can be tracked. So huge innovation.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations. I feel much better about those stampable eggs. It is good to track them back to the hen that's probably, you know, living in cramped, horrible conditions. And it feels better with the stamp. It just feels a lot better.
Yeah, I'm certainly going to sleep better tonight knowing that you can track eggs back to
Me too.
Abused hens.
Me too.
Yeah.
All right. That's it for Heroes and Zeros for this week. We look forward to finding more of your heroes and zeros throughout the animal law world in our next two-week bi-weekly episode. Right, Greg?
That's right.
All right, we're back with questions and answers. We have a couple of questions this week. Please, please, we ask our listeners, get us in with some new questions. And by the way, while I'm here, I'm also going to pimp for our listeners. It's been every once in a while I go check out the iTunes page, and we had this initial flurry of stars and reviews, and I got to tell you, I live for those stars. Like, I live for the reviews and the stars. And I don't know, Camille, without those reviews and stars, I just feel like a lesser person as a podcast host. So if you can give us a review on iTunes, we'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, go visit us on iTunes, leave us a review. It helps people find this podcast, and you're increasing people's exposure to animal issues, so it's a good thing.
Absolutely. Okay, our Q&A, our first question is from Art of Andrea Boyd on Twitter. Did Animal Justice have any input in the latest revision of the said-to-be new and more legally binding code of practice for kennel operations, which breeders in New Brunswick must comply with? Camille, any idea?
Well, thanks, Andrea, for the question. As it happens, we are doing a future episode on dog breeding, so we have done a little bit of research into this whole issue to prepare for it. And Andrea, maybe you have more current information than I do, but what appears to be the case is that breeders are supposed to comply with some aspects of this code of practice, which comes from the Canadian Veterinary Medical Association, but not all of it. And it's primarily incorporated as a defense to a charge of animal cruelty or a provincial charge rather than like a requirement. So, you know, drop us a line and let us know if you have any more information. But we are going to be talking about this at length in the future episode. What exactly are the laws that breeders have to comply with? And how does that differ province from province? So we'll follow up on this potentially with more information at that point. But thanks, Andrea, for the question. And Peter, we've got another question from Caitlin Foster, who sent this in by email, and she says that she's a new listener to the show and really enjoys the content so far, and it has helped me become more aware of ways I can be involved in animal justice in Canada. So her question is, what is the best way to share my opinion with lawmakers, and how do I contact them? Who should I contact on the federal level, and how much does this impact their decision-making process?
Well, Camille, this is much more your area than mine, but I'll just throw out my view is it helps to contact anyone. Certainly your local MP is always a good person to contact to show that you're a concerned citizen. I think that MPs are very cognizant of letters. You know, maybe if you live in Robert Sopuck's jurisdiction, it's not going to go very far. But in other parts of Canada, I think that MPs have shown themselves willing to listen to what their constituents have to say, and certainly putting a word into them or as well to the Justice Minister and others is certainly a useful thing to do. I don't think you can look at it as, oh, they're going to answer and have some immediate impact and suddenly make changes that are progressive for animals. But I do think that showing a greater level of interest and support in these issues is always helpful.
I totally agree with all of that, Peter. And you know, I would say that MPs I speak with, and, you know, I do meet with MPs, I sometimes go with constituents to have meetings, they're often really appreciative of knowing more about these issues and simply didn't know much about animal issues before. I went to a meeting recently with one MP who was just appalled to learn about animal transport laws in Canada and how bad they really are. And she was just astounded to learn of this. And so I think these meetings can be really educational for MPs. So I would encourage you, as a first step, try to meet with your MP. You can go on their website. If you visit the Parliament of Canada's website, you can put in your postal code and find out who your MP is if you don't already know. They have contact information listed on that website for their offices. They have a Parliament Hill office in Ottawa, and they all have local constituency offices as well, which is something in your riding. So try to set up a meeting in that constituency office for a time when they're going to be in the constituency. And that's usually over the weekends or on an off week when Parliament isn't sitting or during the summer or over the holidays potentially. So the best option is to sit down with them, potentially try to bring somebody else with you to show that there's more than one person in the riding that supports animal issues. And if you have a hard time actually meeting with them because it's not close to you or not convenient or you just can't schedule a time, setting up a phone call is also a great idea. And as a next step, you could send an email. So I would encourage you just to stay on your MP. Make sure that they know there's people in their riding that vote on animal issues, because frankly, this makes a big difference. And just as one final step, because I love talking about this stuff, I could talk about this for a half an hour. Peter, we should do a whole episode on it sometime.
Please. Soon, Camille. Let's do it very soon.
This is not up Peter's alley so much as it is up mine. But the last thing I want to say is that if there's an election, and this applies federally, provincially, municipally, I encourage people to get out, find an animal-friendly candidate, identify that person, and knock on some doors for them, pass out some literature for them, volunteer on their campaign, and just show them that animal people are out there, we care, we're politically engaged, we're active, we're going to bring voters into their camp, and that they can rely on us for volunteer resources during an election. It makes a difference, and it will help keep them on track after they get elected and might be lobbied by the egg industry or the fishing or hunting industries and might be tempted to sway their vote in the wrong direction. So that's it for our Q&A segment. Like we said, if you have any questions, feel free to tweet us or email us info@animaljustice.ca, and we'll do our best to answer them next time.
We'd like to thank all our listeners for tuning in. Please, a reminder, you can subscribe to the Paw and Order podcast using iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcatcher. And please, please leave us a rating and a review, which helps us reach more people.
You can also share the podcast so that others have the opportunity to listen to it. And we always welcome donations to Animal Justice, which makes Paw and Order possible.
You can find me on Twitter at Peter Sankoff, on Facebook at Professor Sankoff, and at my website, petersankoff.com.
And you can find me online on Twitter at Camille Labchuk, same handle on Instagram. And we always enjoy Twitter conversations about the show or any other animal law or political topics. And finally, thank you so much to our producer, Shannon Milling.
See you next time on Paw and Order.